Okay, here we go. Coming up Friday morning.
Halloween, wow. Next week?
It is daycare Halloween parade day. So it's a big day.
Oh, that's huge. That's huge. Yeah.
That's obviously top of mind for everyone out there.
Of course.
So that's what we're doing later. It seems like the rain is going to not be as bad as yesterday, so at least the kids won't get wet. And it's always just so fun to do all these Halloween things.
It is.
It's just so great. Having kids is great. Let's talk about the news here on JR Morning. Trump has changed course a little bit when it comes to Russia. And we just talked with Austin Gullett yesterday on this show, and he was saying, yeah, things are feeling a little different when it comes to tone, rhetoric. Well, yesterday, President Trump said it was time to hit Russia with tougher sanctions. He said, quote, today is a very big day in terms of what we're doing. These are tremendous sanctions. These are very big, and they are against two big oil companies in Russia, and it could make the pain be felt there in Russia. Here's the president talking about these sanctions.
Today is a very big day in terms of what we're doing. Look, these are tremendous sanctions. These are very big. Those are against their two big oil companies. And we hope that they won't be on for long. We hope that the war will be settled. We just answered having to do with the various forms of missiles and everything else that we're looking at. But we don't think that's going to be necessary. We would like to see them just take the line that has been formed over quite a long period of time and go and let's, you know, go home. Last week, they had almost 8,000 soldiers killed. Many Russians were killed last week. Many Ukrainians were killed last week. We think it's ridiculous and would like to have it end.
And so by doing this, they're hoping that it might end the war. These are against, like you said, the two biggest oil companies in Russia, open joint stock company Rosneft Oil Company and Lukoil OAO. And Scott Bessent is saying that the Treasury Department is prepared to take further action if necessary to support President Trump's effort to end yet another war. And he talked about missiles, not so much Tomahawks, but the Trump administration lifted restriction on Ukraine's use of some long-range missiles, which can go into Russia.
Yes.
So things are escalating.
Well, yeah, they are. And I guess the president understands that, you know, who he's dealing with. You know, he tries to be diplomatic with Vladimir Putin, and they talk, and then they're going to meet. Now they're not going to meet. And, you know, you can't trust them. And you can try to finesse Vladimir Putin all you want to, but he's still going to do what he wants to.
Yeah, and these are the first sanctions issued by President Trump in this second term against Russia. And according to experts, these two companies targeted Wednesday are two of the world's biggest, and they export 3.1 million barrels of oil per day. Rosneft alone responsible for 6% of global and nearly half of all Russian oil production.
Well, we're in what is this, day 23?
Well, it's October 23rd. That's how I keep track of this. It's the 23rd day of this shutdown. And I believe it was the 12th time they voted in the Senate. But again, it's the same thing over and over.
Insanity.
Democrats are not budging when it comes to shifting their, you know, stance. Fetterman from Pennsylvania, my home state, he says you got to pick country over party.
2 million Pennsylvanians depend on SNAP for to helping feed themselves and their family. 2 million. And now that's going to be suspended because our government is shut down. I can't ever vote for that kinds of mass food insecurity like that. And now I'm going to be a county. Excuse me, I'm a country over party guy. I'm always going to vote to pay our military over the party. I'm always going to vote to pay the Capitol Police here versus over the party.
So he's saying you got to vote to open it, and he is alone in his thinking.
Well, you know, but I have to give it to him. He stands up for what he believes in, and he says what he wants to say, and, you know, he's like, take it or leave it. But, yeah, I get it. It's time to open. Both sides at this point, people are hurting.
Yeah.
And they're like, I need to pay my bills.
Yeah.
And I don't care who's pointing fingers at who. Get it done.
Right.
A transport truck claiming to be lost nearly became the first vehicle to cross the new Gordie Howe International Bridge, which is not open.
Trivia question.
It's not open. The driver coming from the United States side was intercepted by Canadian officials and turned back without incident. Now, officials say the driver was trying to find the nearby Ambassador Bridge and became disoriented amid the size and complexity of the construction site.
Relatable.
You can relate to that?
Yes.
Okay. The Canada Border Services Agency confirmed that no firearms were drawn and that multiple security barriers prevented the truck from entering Canada. No legal penalties were issued. The Gordie Howe Bridge, which connects Detroit to Windsor, had been scheduled to open in late 2025 this year. However, officials say that the opening has been delayed till 2026 to allow for ongoing testing and quality reviews. And construction milestones, including connecting the bridge decks and dismantling the tower cranes, have already been achieved. Officials say the incident highlights the security measures in place at the half-mile crossing, supported by massive cables stretching from concrete pillars to the deck. So he got a little disoriented, and he was going to take a trip over to Canada.
Well, I'm glad that it all, you know,
all
this guy's
out.
Not in trouble. He just made a wrong turn.
Made a wrong
and
turn.
Everyone, cooler heads, everybody, it's fine.
And all, you know, the bridges together, and he didn't.
And he's not the very first one to drive over it.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yesterday was the funeral service for Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick. They, a lot of Detroit, they honored the life and legacy of the former U.S. Congresswoman. She died on October 7th at the age of 80. She was a longtime public servant. Cheeks Kilpatrick taught in Detroit public schools before serving in the Michigan House from 1979 to 1996 and in Congress from 1997 to 2011, where she chaired the Congressional Black Caucus and served on the Appropriations Committee. And at the service at Greater Emmanuel Church of God in Christ, family and local leaders remembered her as a trailblazer, a devoted mother, a strong matriarch. Mayor Mike Duggan called her one of a kind. Governor Gretchen Whitmer highlighted the public dollars she brought to Detroit. Her son, former Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, performed the eulogy and spoke of her fierce love, discipline, and faith, recalling personal moments even during his time in prison. Now, Cheeks Kilpatrick's life inspired colleagues, constituents, and family alike, leaving a legacy of leadership, service, and devotion to both her community and to her family. She was the one who brought the bacon. You talk about bringing the bacon home. You know, the Q line, she brought money home for the Q line, the Rosa Parks terminal downtown. That was money for that. She brought money home for the riverfront.
Mm-hmm.
She really made sure Detroit got what it was supposed to get. And, you know, she will be missed. Very, very nice service yesterday.
Yes, I saw that on Local 4, some of the coverage there on Local 4. And it
yeah.
seems like Kwame was, you know. Yeah. Pretty impassioned in his eulogy.
Yeah, he really was. And, you know, it just know it's hard to eulogize your mom.
I bet.
It's difficult.
Yeah.
You know, so.
I bet. Sports yesterday. First of all, we were all pumped for the Pistons. Pumped for the Pistons. Looks like they do need Jaden Ivey to get better and come back. They were in Chicago. They lost 115-111. But the score is a little closer than it looked early on.
Yeah. Because they had to come
As
back.
As Ryan said, they were getting worked.
Yeah.
Cade Cunningham led the way with 23. But, yeah, so they're 0-1. We'll see how they bounce back from that. The Red Wings had won 5 in a row, but they dropped one to the Buffalo Sabres. They're 5-2 now. This Emmett Finney is the real deal. He scored again for Detroit. JT Comfort was the other goal. So they lose 4-2 to the Sabres. So, also, they were, like, blacked out on TNT. Some people were trying to watch him on TNT, but they were on FanDuel Plus, blah, 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 whatever.
You know, it's like...
And people couldn't find the Red Wings because they were on, like, the Plus Plus, whatever, of FanDuel.
Plus or minus.
And TNT was blacked out here in Detroit. So that was tough, I'm sure, for people trying to find the Red Wings.
God.
All these streaming services.
You just get confused.
Yeah.
You don't know how to watch what
exactly,
you want to watch.
Exactly.
Five Things First Thing with JR Morning. On 760 WJR.
Okay. Coming up next on JR Morning, we're going to go back to Washington, to Capitol Hill, to see if anybody's budging on this shutdown at 619.
Welcome back to JR Morning. After another marathon night on Capitol Hill, the Senate once again failed to advance the House-passed funding bill that would end the government shutdown, marking the 12th failed attempt. Oregon Democrat Jeff Markley held the floor for more than 22 hours, delivering a speech condemning what he called President Trump's authoritarianism. And now to break down the latest developments and what comes next, we're joined by Fox correspondent, WJR contributor Ryan Smales. Ryan, good morning.
Good morning, Lloyd.
So
authoritarian is.
Words are hard at 6:21.
It really is.
It's very hard. Trust me. Oh, I know.
So listen, okay, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting to get a different outcome. I mean, it's insanity. So 12 failed votes now. So what are we doing here?
Well, I think that everyone's hoping that one side is going to crack here. And, you know, Republicans have always felt that they've given Democrats a pretty fair deal when it comes to a funding bill that really has no spending cuts or anything like that attached to it. But Democrats have dug their heels in, and they've refused to move off their position in terms of wanting health care for, you know, as part of this negotiation. Now, you know, I think Republicans got even more emboldened by the whole thing yesterday because there were a series of news articles put out about the people who might be impacted. Well, I don't know if you saw this, but Senator Amy Klobuchar shared this one article from CNBC, and it was about a couple that was making $136,000 in pensions. They were early retirees in their 50s. And I mean, that Republicans were seizing on that and just really going after it.
So, you know, everyone's sort of digging in and they just keep putting this vote up that keeps failing. Are there any, you know, behind closed doors talks? Is anyone trying to find an off ramp here?
There's like a couple conversations going on here and there, but in terms of leadership, no. Right now, Hakeem Jeffries and Leader Schumer are trying to get President Trump to meet with them. And President Trump has said that he will meet with them to talk about the Affordable Care Act tax credits, but he's not going to do that till after the government is reopened. So, you know, everyone was kind of wondering if President Trump was going to weigh in at some point and whether he was going to, you know, help move the needle one direction or the other. Well, President Trump has weighed in, and pretty much he's backing what Speaker Johnson and Leader Thune are doing, essentially.
Are you hearing from anybody on both sides, Ryan, about how much longer they're willing to let this drag out?
Well, you have some Republicans on the House side, more conservative members who are flirting with this idea of nuking the filibuster and trying to encourage Leader Thune to nuke the filibuster. Mm-hmm. He has not given any indication he's willing to do that in order to keep the government open. But you'll have somebody like John Fetterman, Democrat, one of the few who's been voting with Republicans on these bills, saying that he would be supportive of Republicans nuking the filibuster. And, you know, that would be kind of ironic because I believe Fetterman campaigned on ending the filibuster. And wouldn't it be funny if if he was able to get that done by convincing Republicans to do it? So, you know, weird times we're living in if that's what actually happens.
Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted about this, too, that Republicans could open up the government doing it that way.
Yes. I mean, it's something I haven't seen before where I've seen this many Republicans actually open to, you know, getting rid of the 60-vote threshold, at least for CRs in particular and clean extensions of funding. But, you know, I think there's always been that thought in Republican circles that if you were to do that for this, you are opening up the floodgates for the next time Democrats control the Senate. And, you know, there's been a concern about what could happen with Medicare for All, some of these other, you know, progressive policies that have been floated before. Well, you nuke the 60-vote threshold, they could easily become law.
And so, Ryan, if either side, either one of the sides blinks and maybe gives in or negotiates or whatever like that, is this going to hurt them next year?
Well, herein lies the problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you look at both sides, well, Republicans feel that they've already given up a lot by just simply doing a simple extension of funding with no conservative policy attached to it, no spending cuts. You know, you're re-upping Biden-era spending levels. And there are some Republicans who had to swallow a pill to vote for that bill. So they feel if they give up anything more, it's a bad look. Well, Democrats, kind of the same thing. Well, if they fought for this long and have held off for this long in terms of voting for an extension of funding, they feel that if they don't get something out of this at this point, that's a bad look. So this has kind of been a perfect storm of politics for both sides that is kind of leading us to the situation we're in right now.
I'm told Rand Paul and Gary Peters are hosting a lunch.
Yeah.
Supposed to be bipartisan later on today with bourbon.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's supposed to get the conversation going.
Uh-huh.
Who's RSVPing?
Yeah. I saw someone floating an over under on there, but you know, if I weigh in on that, I might get in trouble. But if you saw the menu that was leaked out, somebody said to me they would reopen the government for that menu. So you got to keep in mind too, these bipartisan lunches do happen all the time. I accidentally walked in on one time. I was not supposed to be there, but you know, someone gave me bad directions, and I stumbled in and saw a bunch of people from both sides having lunch together. So it's a more common thing than you think, especially on the Senate side. But you know, maybe this one does move the needle, but who knows?
Kentucky Fried and baked chicken and okra are on the menu. Ooh. Plus Michigan cherry salad. This is all according to Axios.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they weren't advertising any Kentucky bourbon, so I was kind of a little disappointed about that.
So you're not going to stumble into this one. Got it.
Well, I might. I mean, you never know when you get lost.
You might smell. Might get you, you know?
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. I mean, look, if someone gives me bad directions, I can't, you know, blame myself for where I show up.
I got to ask before we go about this, this 22-hour speech from Merkley. I mean, really, what does that do? I mean, optics. I mean, I don't know. What does it do? I mean, he didn't beat the record. So, I mean, what's the big deal?
I remember after Cory Booker finished his speech, you know, there weren't really any Republicans criticizing him. There was actually at least one in the chamber applauding him for what he did, even though Republicans disagreed with what he was saying. I think overall it was it wasn't perceived poorly, you know, but this one by Merkley, the Republican reaction to it's been a heck of a lot different, where you saw the number two Senate Republican, John Barrasso, get on the mic stand immediately afterwards and say, "What did the Democrats accomplish?" So it's a very, very different reaction to this one. And Republicans, they were not happy with what they just saw.
Day 23 and counting. Ryan Smells, Fox News Radio correspondent, WJR contributor. Appreciate you.
Hey, have a good one, Lloyd. Thank you.
You as well. I don't know how long this is going to go, but let me tell you, the American people who are missing those checks are not happy right now. Coming up, more on JR Morning at 6:35.
Have you seen this discussion about the White House reno?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what we know is that President Trump's building a ballroom, huge, huge ballroom, and he needs room for it. And the East Wing is being
demolished.
It looks demolished. We'll see what the final result is. Mm-hmm. We do know that the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a nonprofit chartered by Congress to further the historic preservation policy in the U.S., wrote a letter on Tuesday to say, let's pause this demolition of the East Wing for now until a review of this ballroom plan is completed. The ballroom annex, this proposed new construction, will overwhelm the White House itself. That's according to this group. Mm-hmm. But the trust has no statutory authority to compel Trump or the administration to do anything. So they really have no teeth when they say something like that. Last week, the Society of Architectural Historians raised similar concerns about the size of this ballroom and its impact on the White House grounds. And in August, a letter from the American Institute of Architects also focused on the ballroom's size, that this 90,000 square foot addition raises concerns regarding scale and balance, and the design absolutely must harmonize with the White House's existing architectural proportions. So these are folks saying the scale is off. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this before we do anything. Again, those people that I just mentioned.
Yeah.
They have no statutory role in the design of the ballroom. So
but nobody's
no
really
say.
Look knows. I mean, no, he hasn't really introduced the plans to anyone, right?
No. Yeah. The White House said Wednesday that construction plans for this ballroom would be submitted to the National Capital Planning Commission at an appropriate time, and they're hoping to do it soon. But if you've seen the video, the East Wing is just looks a whole lot different.
It does.
Mike Johnson was asked about this White House renovation, and here's what he had to say.
This whole dust up about the White House, just by way of quick review, because I'm an amateur historian, you'll understand the White House has been renovated many times over the years. You understand? I mean, it was built between 1792 and 1800, right? The British burned it down practically in 1814, and then they rebuilt it in the early 1820s. And ever since, like, we've had many presidents renovate and add things to the White House. Teddy Roosevelt built the whole West Wing. Who was it? FDR, Taft, I think, added the Oval Office. FDR made additions. I mean, Truman put the ripped everything up to put a bowling alley in. FDR had added the swimming pool, I think. Barack Obama added a basketball court. President Trump's going to add the greatest improvement to the White House in the history of the building since it was originally constructed in 1800. The ballroom is going to be glorious. It's going to be used for everybody. And by the way, hey, Democrats, if you win the White House back, you get to use it too. This is for the American people, and he's using private funds to do it. How in the world could they oppose that? The only reason, the only logical reason, is because they have Trump derangement syndrome.
He says it's Trump derangement. Anything the president does, people don't like. That's Mike Johnson's point of view.
So the ballroom was for everybody?
It will be for any administration.
Administration?
Right.
Okay.
And when you talk about the President Obama's basketball court, it was like the size of a basketball court outdoors. Yeah. That's slightly different than this 90,000 square foot. And if you've seen the renderings, it does look like, when you look at the whole plan, huge next to the White House. And that's what these folks are saying with, like, let's just see the plans. Let's talk about it. Let's hold off a little bit.
Well,
your thoughts?
I listen, the ballroom, from what I saw, it looks wonderful, actually. It looks pretty nice. I just don't know why you need a 90,000, square foot ballroom. I mean, what are you going to be holding? Unless you're holding very special, officials who come here, and you have a big ballroom, or you're getting ready to hold an MMA fight up in the ballroom, because that's supposed to happen too.
I think they were doing that outside.
Oh, that's going to be outside.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know.
Their point of view is they're going to have state dinners. They're going to host these lavish, parties and stuff in this ballroom that every administration would want it.
Yeah. Well,
other folks are saying the scale's off. Let's talk about it. If you go to Business Insider, there are photos from the last time there was a major construction renovation project at the White House,
right.
And that was in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
It does look huge. There's scaffolding all over the White House.
I've seen several pictures.
Yeah. So that's out there. That's a talker.
Yeah, it definitely is. The Minnesota Supreme Court, they issued this consequential but narrowly focused ruling in this long-running discrimination case involving transgender powerlifter J.C. Cooper. Now, the state's highest court affirmed that Cooper was discriminated against when she was banned from competing in a woman's powerlifting event. This upholds that the Michigan Human Rights Act protects transgender individuals from discrimination in public accommodations, which is being called a major victory for transgender rights advocates. However, the justices notably opened the door for new legal challenges. The court explicitly stated that athletic organizations such as USA Powerlifting can pursue future arguments claiming a legitimate business reason, like maintaining competitive fairness, to justify exemptions. And attorneys for USA Powerlifting immediately confirmed they plan to use this exact argument in the next round of district court proceedings. And while gender justice hailed the ruling as a historic step, some state Republican leaders quickly called the decision a major setback for protecting women's sports. The case now turns to the district court. If my daughter was, in powerlifting, women's powerlifting, I just wouldn't want a transgender competing against her, a person who was born a man who is now transitioned to a woman to compete, because they're just going to be naturally stronger. I just think that's not fair.
Yeah, I mean, there's just physical differences.
It is.
And it seems like it's not fair for any of this to happen when it comes to female sports. I totally get that.
Yeah.
I do think there's a little bit of a difference when it comes to, like, boxing or some of these things that we talked about.
Yeah.
Than this, because this isn't like physical contact between two people. But there's still there's still an unfair advantage here.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder how this, reacts with the EO and like the NCAA and all of this stuff coming down now.
Yeah, well, I just think we haven't heard the last of it, and we'll have more court proceedings and more rulings coming. This is just the beginning, I think.
I wonder how many people, this is a major story because it's the Minnesota Supreme Court. How many people are affected here? How many athletes are affected by this? I don't know that answer. I'm asking.
No, I
don't think
probably
it's that
a small number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But these are big stories because of what we talked about. We find it an unfair advantage.
Right. And then, you open the door and then you just, it snowballs.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Well, we also are giving away $1,000. It's super fun to do that. We've been doing it and we will continue to do so. We are going to give away $1,000. We give out that keyword every morning at 8:19, and we will be doing that again. What would you spend $1,000 on?
Oh, man.
We had a fun discussion last week. Let's say a new thing now.
Oh, something new?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably a nice wardrobe. You know, I like clothes.
Yes.
So, you know, probably, you know.
My new thing is groceries. I bought groceries 2 days ago, and it was like one of those mini carts, and it was like three bags, $150.
Oh, absolutely.
$150 when I was like in college would like feed me for a week or two.
Yes, $150 don't buy you $50 worth of groceries.
I didn't even buy meat. I just bought, you know, the staples.
The staples, yeah.
$150, three bags. It was very sad looking in the back of the car. $150. That's what I would use it for. All right, so again, we're going to give that away at 8:19. Coming up at 6:49, we're going to talk about these cell phone bans and how it's actually affecting students. We have a researcher coming up. Well, Lloyd, we've been talking about cell phone bans, and 20-plus states have some kind of law or ban when it comes to cell phones in schools. Uh-huh. Michigan's still in the talking phase.
Yes.
We're not there yet. We want to know what the effects are, and some researchers did the work here in Florida, finding that test scores rose, attendance improved, although there were some disciplinary problems also when
initially
you put something like this
yeah
in place. David Figlio is professor of economics and education at University of Rochester, one of those researchers who put in this work. Good morning, David.
Hi, good morning. Nice to be here.
This is something all parents, all teachers, lawmakers even are very interested in. Tell us about the research first and what you found.
Sure. So this is a place where this is a domain where the policy is going way, way, way ahead of the research. And we sought to provide the first evidence that actually looks at the causal effects of cell phone bans on student outcomes. So here's what we found. We found that the schools that were more subject to the cell phone ban experienced modest but significant improvements in test scores. They saw that unexcused absences went down, more student engagement in the school. But in the first year of the program, we saw that there was an increase in disciplinary action, suspensions, which were really concentrated amongst Black students. That dissipated substantially by the second year, but in the first year we saw that.
Do you think, you know, those growing pains are inevitable when schools implement some, you know, strict new rules, or could better planning help ease that transition?
You know, I think the answer is yes and yes, right? It is very rare that you can go and introduce something that's so massively different from what kids have been experiencing without some growing pains, no matter how well the you plan in advance. But on the other hand, this was a study in Florida. Florida required that students at least keep their phones in their pocket, right? There are some states that have proposed or implemented bans in which the cell phones were locked away. To the extent to which we were seeing some of these growing pains happening because maybe phones were nearby and kids couldn't help but sneak a look or something of that nature. Again, I don't know if that's a story or not, but that's a story.
So modest but significant when it comes to test scores. What is that number?
Sure. So let me try to put in language like SAT scores. Imagine that a typical kid got a 10-point increase in the SAT as a consequence. We're not talking 100 points, but we're not talking zero either.
Okay. And so this is a anonymous school district. You're not saying where this was, right?
That's correct. That's
okay.
Correct. It's one of the big school districts in Florida, but I can't say which one.
Did you talk to teachers, or was it merely just numbers?
You know, Umut Ozek, my co-author, and I we're large, big data, quantitative scholars.
Mm-hmm.
However, I certainly have carried out a lot of conversations with teachers. I always talk with teachers when I'm carrying out my research. Certainly, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that teachers in Florida and elsewhere have seen that there is an improvement in classroom environment. Angela Duckworth at University of Pennsylvania has been leading a big survey about this exact study topic, I should say.
David, I'm wondering if the effects of these bans were more visible among middle and high school students, as you know, and not maybe so much elementary school students.
Well, that's exactly what we found. But of course, that kind of makes sense, right? Because most of the cell phone usage is in middle and high schools, especially middle schools.
Let's talk about the disciplinary data that you have. So was that, you know, early on in the research and when this just ban put into effect, or did it continue in year two, the disciplinary stuff?
It was really mostly the first part of the first year. It continued to some degree throughout the first year and into the second year, but we're really seeing this exactly the way Lloyd was describing it, as kind of like a growing pains. That's how we're interpreting this.
And, you know, we're seeing this nationwide movement right now, David, and, you know, you got states like New York, they're expanding bans to include smartwatches even, and, you know, other let local districts decide. From your point of view, does a statewide policy make more sense, or is a district-by-district approach more effective?
So now we're getting out in front of my research. However, I have been studying state and local policy for 30 years. Uh-huh. I say statewide policies in general are going to be more effective than local policies, right? You have a lot more clarity about what's in the policy and what's not. There is less room for interpretation. So even though I couldn't say my research suggests that we should have a statewide policy as opposed to a local policy, I tend to think that that a statewide policy would make a little more sense.
So what is your takeaway from this data as the first study, the first paper doing this?
Okay, so my takeaway is this is one of the rare cases in which common sense seems actually to be backed up with the numbers. So often in my career, I've heard people say, oh, well, this is obviously going to happen, and it didn't. Here's a case in which educators, policymakers said it's obvious it's going to happen, and it did. So what does this mean? Well, half the states in the country are imposing bans like this. We need to see research like ours replicated in other places. I'd also love to see people study different types of cell phone bans. For example, do we include smartwatches? Do we exclude them? Do we put phones in lockers or yonder pouches? Are pockets okay? Mm-hmm. Importantly, I want to know more about what's happening with discipline. For example, is it the case in this case that Black students were more likely to violate the ban, or are they more likely to be targeted by educators? I don't know the answer to that yet. We need to learn those things.
Well, this is great work. This is you know, great research and data that we can rely on when we're thinking about cell phones and our kids. Thank you so much, David Figlio.
Thanks for having me on.
At the end of his paper here, he talks about enforcement too, like how are schools going to enforce that and what are the consequences? And so there are a lot more questions now, but at least this is a first start of looking into this. So good stuff there from David Figlio. Coming up next on JR Morning, we're going to talk about the news of the day, including this $230 million restitution the president is asking for. That's coming up on JR Morning. Nope, it's Lloyd Jackson and Jamie Edmonds.
Yep, Chris is still
overseas. We will be reunited with Chris on Monday. Happy Thursday to everybody listening, October 23rd, which also equals the 23rd day of the government shutdown. That's an easy way to figure out how long we've been in this shutdown.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're digging their heels in. Everyone is. We had another vote in the Senate. Yep. Nothing happened. Fetterman, our senator from Pennsylvania,
from your hometown. Yeah.
My home state, was talking on Fox, and he was saying, you know, I got to put country over party when SNAP benefits are starting to affect people, and real effects are starting to happen here.
2 million Pennsylvanians depend on SNAP for it to helping feed themselves and their family. 2 million. And now that's going to be suspended because our government is shut down. I can't ever vote for that kinds of mass food insecurity like that. And now I also, I'm going to be a country over party guy. I'm always going to vote to pay our military over the party. I'm always going to vote to pay the Capitol Police here versus over the party. I mean, I'm always going to vote country over my party. And if I pay a price within my base, you know, that's something I'm willing to do because I happen to believe it's very true.
That's the interesting part at the end, that he thinks this is just the right thing to do. And if it hurts him in a primary or with his base, he's fine with
it. He's okay with it.
I don't think a lot of lawmakers are willing to do those things.
They're not thinking like that.
Right.
No.
Mm-mm. And not just on the shutdown. I just mean overall.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so no movement there on the shutdown. Uh-huh. Obviously, Ryan Schmelz, we'll all keep an eye on.
Yeah, but long speeches, though. You know, you can have a long 22 hours. I mean, what does that do? I don't know.
Also, this idea of President Trump saying that the Justice Department should pay him $230 million in compensation for the federal investigations that occurred into him. The situation has no parallel in American history. This has never happened before. A presidential candidate pursued by federal law enforcement who then won an election, then taking over the government that must now review the claim.
Yeah.
And who's going to decide if this goes through? People that President Trump put into place that used to be his personal attorney.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's some ethics questions here, and we're going to get into it with Barb McQuaid, law professor at University of Michigan at 819. I'm sure she has some thoughts.
$230 million of taxpayer money.
Lloyd has an idea.
I think he should, you know.
He said he's going to give it, if this happens, he's going to give it to charity. Okay. Lloyd's idea is?
You know, spread it to the people.
And I said, okay, cool. But there's like 300-something million people. So well, what, we're going to get a percentage of a dollar?
Just, you know, certain people.
Who? Lloyd?
Me.
Lloyd Jackson? You're available?
Hey, listen.
Okay.
Who am I to say?
If he wants to give it to you.
Hey, okay. You know. A $500 million lawsuit alleging the Michigan Department of Corrections instructed guards to use body cameras during routine strip searches at the Women's Huron Valley Correctional Facility has been dismissed by a judge. The lawsuit filed in May of this year on behalf of 20 women claimed that inmates were subjected to lewd comments and behavior during searches and that Michigan is the only state to record women during strip searches. Plaintiffs alleged violations included invasion of privacy, emotional distress, sex-based discrimination, and constitutional rights. Flood Law, which represents the women, said the case exposes a grotesque abuse of power and noted that many inmates suffered severe psychological and physical effects. On October 15th of this year, the suit was dismissed, but the law firm announced plans to appeal, calling the case meritorious and seeking a second review by the courts.
Interesting. Interesting.
So maybe we'll have to get Todd on to talk about this as well.
I'm sure he would.
Yes.
All right. Give him a ring. The Detroit News has an editorial as of yesterday calling Hegseth sort of out of line here. They're saying that these new Pentagon restrictions on journalists, which have been universally rejected, mm-hmm. and all the people cleaned their desks and left, is not warranted and that it's not right. They say, quote, at a time when public debate over defense policy, spending, and global engagement is constant, a free and independent press is an essential check on the workings of the military. Hegseth, a former Fox News journalist, should know this. Now, the Pentagon says this is just about protecting classified information, but as Brett Baer said, as Jack Keane said, there were already strict rules on these journalists within the Pentagon. They didn't go down certain hallways.
Right.
They didn't go in certain rooms. Mm-hmm. But they were able to be a watchdog on the Pentagon and military operations.
Do you think this is going to keep them from not being watchdogs, even though they're not in the Pentagon anymore?
Yes.
You think it's going to keep them from being
I think location matters. Yes.
Well, it does to a certain point, but I think if you have sources and people that you deal with, I just think you can still get the information.
But there's new penalties now that they're placing on people for talking to the press, too.
Yeah, well, I mean...
So then that's no.
It's a different way to do it.
Again, back to the editorial. Historically, the press has exposed failures of strategy, uncovered mistreatment of veterans, and revealed waste in defense contracting. It's a service that is still very much necessary. The Department of Defense should immediately rescind the press restrictions and affirm its commitment to open government. That is according to the Detroit News, and I agree with them.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Detroiters feeling more optimistic about the city than they have over a decade. A new Detroit News WDIV-TV poll shows 76% of likely voters believe the city is moving in the right direction, a dramatic turnaround from 2012 when two-thirds said Detroit was on the wrong track. The survey also found strong approval for Mayor Mike Duggan and the city council, 82% and 67% approval, respectively, compared to with much lower ratings more than a decade ago. Residents report feeling safer, with 80% saying they feel secure in their neighborhoods, up from just 51% in 2012. And many voters now say they're going to stay in Detroit long term. In 2025, 75% say they expect to remain in the city over the next 10 years, a significant increase from 2012. While property crime remains a concern for some, the overall mood is hopeful, reflecting years of revitalization, infrastructure improvements, and renewed investment under Mayor Duggan's leadership. Hmm. People feeling good about the city. I mean, the city is, you know, we have some issues just like every other city.
Right.
But for the most part, you know, the city has really come back from 2012 from bankruptcy.
The vibe check is good.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's have some fun. As always, the news is heavy. We need to have some fun. I'm told Dr. Steve has a fun one today.
Oh, looking forward
to it. So we're going to talk with Dr. Steve. Therapy Thursday coming up at 7:19. It's time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Small Business Saturday is right around the corner. Roughly a month from now, we'll be focused on spending our purchase dollars at our favorite local merchants. And you can do more than shop. You can actually help promote shopping locally in your community by applying to become a neighborhood small business champion today. The Main Street America organization is a proud supporter of Small Business Saturday, and they're teaming up with American Express to help you support small businesses on your Main Street as a neighborhood champion. All Main Street America members are pre-qualified to serve as neighborhood champions on a first-come, first-served basis. Space is limited, so claim your spot before applications close. All you need to do to apply is fill out a brief neighborhood champion application and indicate you were referred by National Main Street Center. As a neighborhood champion, you'll rally your community to shop small on Small Business Saturday. That's November 29th this year and throughout the remainder of the holiday season. You can plan and host local events on Small Business Saturday in partnership with small businesses in your community, and you can distribute a complimentary Shop Small kit of merchandise that encourages holiday shoppers to support small businesses all season long. Applications will remain open through mid-November or until spots are filled, so be sure to apply at www.americanexpress.com and navigate to the Small Business Shop Small section of the website. You can apply right there, and it gives you the opportunity to support your local community by sponsoring the interest in shopping locally right on your Main Street. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Welcome back to JR Morning. It is Thursday. It is time for Therapy Thursday with Dr. Steve Craig from Craig Counseling Services. And we have a scenario that's a fun one today. We need some fun.
We ready for fun?
I'm ready
Let's
for
do
fun.
It.
All right. Well, maybe hopefully we sold that one right. All right.
You better deliver fun.
Dr. Steve, my wife and I are newly married and are now a blended family. We each have a 10 and 12-year-old child, and now all four of them live with us. Both of our previous spouses were very strict, overbearing parents, but we are different. We believe in positive reinforcement and teaching people to stand on their own without having to have a parent involved with everything. So we've created a system of positive reward where if our children solve a conflict on their own and they work it out without having a parent do it for them, they get a dollar or maybe $5 if it's a big fight. This way, they will work out problems themselves and learn good conflict resolution skills without overbearing parents controlling everything. But our question is there an appropriate amount of reward, you know, the $1 or $5, I guess, or should it be something other than money? And how long until they've mastered it so we can pull back on the program? So they're really asking, that's the program.
How long we got to pay them off?
How long we got to pay them off, and how much should we pay them off?
This one's hard.
It is. Because, you know, money is always a great reward. And once they get into adulthood, you know, they'll be getting paid and based on how they, you know, are able to work out problems and deal with problems. But they're 10 and 12. You know, I think 5 is good. And I think you do it until they get maybe 16 or 17, and you pull back.
Okay. My initial reaction here is that it's like a dangerous precedent to give them money for doing something they should know how to do. And there could be other kinds of rewards, possibly, if they resolve things on their own. But, like, you're never going to be able to pull it back if you're paying them for things.
Well, you can pull it back. If you're paying them, you can pull it back whenever you feel like it. Okay. My money.
All right. My
answer is I don't think it's an appropriate reward.
You know, Jamie wins Therapy Thursday too many times. We gotta we should talk ahead of time or something.
Yeah,
you can give him the answer.
Yeah, give me the answer. Me and Chris, man, we are just not having it.
We're not even going to answer the question that they post because this is a disaster. Okay, this is almost guaranteed to get more fights. This is why you need a psychologist to set up these reward or systems, not just yourself from a YouTube video or something. And the reason is, and this is why I think this one is fun, this is what's called a perverse incentive, okay? And the best way to describe it is something called the Cobra effect. And I don't imagine anyone's ever heard of that. But the Cobra effect is back in the day when Britain was ruling India, a lot of the Brits got there and there were cobras everywhere. And I mean, I haven't been to India, but they say there's lots of cobras around, but they're not really, they don't attack people, so they're around. But the people from Britain didn't like the cobras, so they put a bounty on cobra carcasses. So if you bring me it's $100 for a dead cobra.
Okay.
So it didn't take long for a whole bunch of people to start breeding cobras so that they could make money. So there was this whole underground system of people breeding cobras, killing them, and bringing it to the government to get money.
And now you have more cobras.
But then
I see where you're going.
The British government got onto the scam and called off the program. So now that then when that happened, all the people just released all the cobras, and they ended up with way more cobras than they started with.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perverse incentive. And so that's the same thing here. It doesn't take long for crafty children to figure out, well, what are we going to do here? Mm-hmm. Well, if I get in a fight with you and we stage the fight and then we go resolve it, we get paid. So you can't build incentives in that are perverse like that because you can end up getting more, you know, more than you planned.
Mm-hmm.
And kids do this all the time. My kids just revealed that they did this to us. Two psychologist parents, the little rats, right. We told them when they were both teenagers and sharing a car, they had to pay for gas. They had it so, like two young boys would do. One would get out, it'd be empty because the brother would have brought it empty. So they'll put in $3 so they can drive to the friend.
Yeah.
So it's always empty. But we said, you work out the problems all the time. Okay. But if you get in a huge fight about it or you can't get to work or there's something, come to us. We'll take care of it. So they had all these huge throwdowns about the gas, you know, and then we'd be like, okay, here, fill it up. And then we find out later they've staged the whole thing.
So you'd put gas in the car.
So we'd put gas in the car. So we incentivize them to fake fights so that we would pay for gas in the car.
But now if you if these parents take the money away and say, okay, we're not doing this anymore. Now these kids were maybe staging some fake fights. Now do they have real fights? And then,
well, this is why I was saying Jamie won. You have to work out there's a built-in incentive to work out conflicts. I don't need to create one. No one really wants these conflicts. But you don't have to put an artificial reward system in there for them. You say, you guys have to work it out. And you keep saying, go back and work it out. And you teach them the conflict resolution skills of Why don't you, you don't have to be overbearing parents who come in and say, you do this and you do that. You can say to them, if you're having a fight with your sister, talk about this. Teach them this and then send them back and they can talk about it. You don't have to reward them in this way. It's a false economy there that's going to create problems.
Okay, this is what I thought of. Not naming any district or anything, but some school districts are saying, we'll pay you if you come to school. And something right. in that, like, I'm like, what? That doesn't feel right to me because you're supposed to go to school anyway.
Correct.
But they aren't. So there is a problem there that schools are trying to solve.
They right. do that on count day. You know, they have special things going on count day because they want you in school so they
right.
can
so, so they can this get is the money an, I don't know, you know, what the story is there, uh-huh. but it has the potential to be a perverse incentive, which is that then I don't go till the days I get paid
uh-huh.
and right. then it can all backfire. So that's why you have to be super careful about these things, is you have to build in ways that you're not getting abused by the crafty people. So even, you know, this example here, their idea is right, and even the school idea is right. You get the people to come to school, but you can't build in perverse things that really will backfire. So,
what about kids and their chores, and then you give them money for that? Thoughts on that? Because they're doing work.
That's mm-hmm. different.
There's value in that.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to do your homework, and you take out the garbage, and you do whatever.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Those are chores. They do A, they get B.
Okay.
But they don't get to mess up the garbage and then get a reward for taking it out, or mm-hmm. take the garbage out, bring the garbage back in, and get money for taking it out again. You know, so you have to be very strict about your responsibilities to do A, you get B. If you, like for the fighting, you could do, we expect no fights. Okay. We expect you guys to not have any fights. And if you don't fight, then everyone's going to get dessert after dinner if you don't fight all day. Okay? Then they've worked out the fights themselves.
Yeah.
But you didn't reward them for getting in one and then fixing it.
That's right. what my dad
so
would do.
You have to figure out a better way to intervene. So if this family were in, I would say, good idea, but let's not build in the wrong incentives.
My dad would say, I don't expect you to fight.
Right.
And then that's it.
Right. You want them in the other room going, hey, quit fighting. We want ice cream tonight. Then they'll work it out themselves because they want the reward. That's different than creating fights.
I do think this was a fun one.
Right.
The Cobra, you delivered the fun.
The Cobra story is fun.
Yeah.
As you hear it, you start to figure it out, you're like, I knew where you were going.
That's going
to
be bad.
Right.
The wheels started turning. Right. And they're like, too many Cobras.
My kids did it to us.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Steve. Stick with us on JR Morning. Welcome back. We have some giveaways. Of course, we're going to give you that keyword at 8:19, and that's your shot at winning $1,000. So you want to stick around for that. Plus, it's WJR's Game Day in the D, your chance to roar when Detroit hosts New York Sunday, November 23rd at Ford Field. You could win tickets, transportation courtesy of Metro Cars, and $100 to dine at Buddy's Pizza. To enter, download the free WJR mobile app. Find the secret keyword, then text it to 800-859-0957. More information on WJR.com. We can't stop. We just like giving stuff away.
Oh, we love it.
Can't stop, won't stop. Okay, let's talk about this article in The Athletic. They talk about the best college football stadiums.
Okay.
How many do you think you've been in?
I know at least one.
Okay. I don't know. One. Maybe a dozen, maybe two dozen for me with my job.
Yeah.
What makes a college football stadium great? They say it could be the architecture. Beautiful scenery doesn't hurt. But they are trying to build this top 25 FBS stadiums. They surveyed a bunch of people at The Athletic. And it's clear that, like, some are memorable because, you know, there are 100,000 people there. Like, Death Valley or the Big House.
The Big House, yeah.
But, you know, the ones that are smaller are still good, too, depending on many variables, like at West Point and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So they put this list together. What do you think is number one?
The Big House?
No, the Big House is number five. For number one, they put LSU's Tiger Stadium at the top.
Okay.
Now, I've never been there.
Okay.
No, so I can't relate to that.
Okay.
But they say that Tiger Stadium Saturday night in Death Valley is an experience, that you smell gumbo. The tailgating is off the chart. They have 100,000 plus fans packing there.
Okay.
The opponents, like, you know, hate LSU. So it's like a real rivalry game, no matter who's playing it. And they just say that that is the best experience. Number two, they say, is Beaver Stadium, Penn State. I have been there.
You've been there. Okay.
The whiteouts are pretty great. Like, it's pretty good. Everyone okay. where they know their assignment.
Okay.
They understand the assignment. They do it. It's gotcha. Pretty great atmosphere. Three is Notre Dame. Yes. Unbelievable. With touchdown Jesus in the background.
Okay.
Four is Ohio Stadium. Also great.
The horseshoe.
I mean, you don't have to like Ohio State to know that that's like a pretty good. It's very loud. Been on the not court, field before. Mm-hmm. It's very loud. It's very cool. And here we go at number five at Michigan. And let's look at their explanation for Michigan at number five. They say that they got there early to the Big House for one of these games. They wanted to walk around. And even when it was empty, it was a sight that when it eventually filled up for this 2008 season opener, it was loud, muggy in August. He just thought that this, like, the atmosphere, the smell, everything about it. So Michigan, so fantastic.
Okay.
Your thoughts? Have you ever been to Michigan Stadium?
I've been to Michigan Stadium twice. I've been to Michigan Stadium, and it's almost overwhelming when you get in there with all those people. It's almost overwhelming.
This person writes that also, like, some stadiums go up with their stands. Michigan Stadium's like a bowl and it goes down.
Yes.
And they were drawn to that, too, that sort of enhances the experience of Michigan Stadium. If you want to round out the top, you can go read about all of these, but I'll give you the numbers here. People love a list. Number six is Neyland Stadium. That's at Texas. Husky Stadium, number seven, Washington. Texas A&M is number eight. The Rose Bowl, number nine. I thought the Rose Bowl might be a little higher, but they're at nine. And then Oregon Stadium is number 10.
How many of those in the top 10 have you gone to?
Let's see. Beaver Stadium, Notre Dame, Ohio State, Michigan, Rose Bowl, five.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
50%.
Okay, so that's just fun stuff
to
talk about there.
Another poll. Got another poll for you.
Love a list.
Okay, so here's another poll from the Detroit News and Channel 4. It reveals a potential disruption in Michigan's 2026 race for governor, with Detroit voters showing a split allegiance that could boost Republican chances. Detroit, which we know is a longtime Democratic stronghold, has long been a source of massive vote margins for the party. However, a survey of 500 likely city voters, this is just the city of Detroit, shows that the entry of an independent candidate, Mayor Mike Duggan, is fracturing Democratic support. In a hypothetical matchup, Duggan received 44% support among Detroit voters, essentially tying with the presumptive Democratic nominee, Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, at 42%. Republican U.S. Representative John James trailed at 2%, with 11% undecided, the margin of error of 4 percentage points. While this is just one city poll, it's a significant. In 2022, Governor Whitmer carried the city with a staggering 95% of the vote, giving her over 157,000 more votes than her Republican opponent, about a third of her statewide margin. Pollster Richard Zuba notes that the numbers show Duggan splits the vote in the state's most Democratic area. This suggests that without Duggan in the race, most of that support would likely swing to the Democratic nominee, Jocelyn Benson, who will need a very high turnout and strong margins in Detroit to win the statewide election. So it seems like, you know, the mayor's entry into it is hurting Democrats more than Republicans.
That was the big question.
Exactly.
Coming into this.
Right. And
of course, for Mike Duggan, he's like, no, it's not going to hurt anyone. I'm going to win. That's what he thinks.
Well, yeah. He's very confident.
Just lastly here, our sports teams did not fare so well yesterday. We were so pumped talking about the Pistons heading to Chicago, opening up the season. Well, now they're 0-1. Again, as my husband put it, they were getting worked in the beginning. So the score of 115-111 Bulls is a little closer than it felt.
Yeah, because they had to come back from behind by 20-some points.
Right. Cade Cunningham led the team with 23, and then Jalen Duren, the big guy, had 15. Welcome to the Pistons, Duncan Robinson. Just 2 points for him, but he's going to be good. He's one of their shooters. The Red Wings, 5-game winning streak, snuffed out by the Buffalo Sabres. They lost 4-2 last night. A lot of people I know were like, how can I watch the Red Wings? I can't find them.
Yeah.
Because they were on like FanDuel +++ because the Pistons were on. So if you didn't have access to the +++, you couldn't see it. And the rest of the country watched them on TNT, but it was blacked out here because of that.
But, you know, what happened to the days, Jamie, of just, you know, turning on one of the networks and watching some sports.
You mean the days when the lines were blacked out?
Oh, God. Yeah. Right. You had to buy tickets at 2 o'clock. Some company bought them at 2 o'clock.
Just so you all, everybody could watch it. Yeah. Those were the good old days.
Wouldn't they, though?
Yeah. Just kidding. Okay. Coming up, we're talking to Jason Rowe, principal of Rowe Strategic. What's happening with this shutdown? 749.
Electric vehicle drivers save big. With Consumers Energy, you can earn up to $620 in rebates and cash back just for charging your EV at home. That's on top of what you're already saving by skipping the gas station and avoiding those regular vehicle maintenance costs. And with nearly 5,000 public charging ports across Michigan and more popping up all the time, you'll spend more time driving and less time charging. Visit consumersenergy.com/EV to learn more. Welcome back to JR Morning. After more than 22 hours on the Senate floor, Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley wrapped up a marathon speech warning about what he calls the authoritarianism of the Trump administration. His 22-hour and 36-minute address fell short of Senator Cory Booker's record earlier this year, but set a new mark for Oregon senators. Merkley's speech drew applause from Democrats in the chamber and renewed debate over the state of political discourse in Washington. And joining us to break down the political implications of this and others' stories, Jason Rowe, principal of Rowe Strategic. Jason, good morning.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Good. So, I mean, 22 hours, 36 minutes. I mean, what do you make of Markley's marathon speech? What was he trying to achieve on the Senate floor?
Well, I feel bad for him because that is quite a test of endurance, and nobody noticed. I think this is fodder for progressive salons and MSNBC, but it's amazing. I probably scan 20 different news sources every morning, and it was hardly mentioned in any publication that I saw this morning, from the New York Times to the Washington Post to Politico. It got passing mentions here and there. And I think we're in an era of political theater where there is so much political theater by so many different politicians that things that once really would have drawn the attention of the nation is just another day at the office for most Americans.
We heard about this bipartisan lunch that's happening today with Gary Peters and Rand Paul. Do you think things like that matter still and talking can happen?
Well, I do, particularly in the Senate, because when you look at the government shutdown that we're locked in right now, that is something unique to the Senate. The House has already, passed the continuing resolution. It's being held up by Senate Democrats. So the fact that, Gary Peters, who is, exiting the stage so he doesn't face, a political backlash from the progressive base for working with Republicans to try to find some form of agreement to get the government back opened. And frankly, Rand Paul is somebody that doesn't just toe the line of Republican leadership. He is a very independent libertarian conservative. So I think it's a good sign. I think if we're going to get the government back open, and I'm not optimistic it's going to happen anytime soon, this is how it does happen, where some of the adults in the room get together and figure out a way to get to the 60 votes necessary in the Senate to get the government back open.
So, Jason, day 23, no funding deal, no negotiations between the president and Democratic leadership. How do you think both parties come out of this looking to the American people?
Well, we've talked about it before. I don't think that this is something that will impact the 2026 elections. It's over a year away. People have largely forgotten that this happened. I do think those that are affected by the Obamacare subsidies, those expire on November 1st. And that's why I'm not optimistic we're going to see anything between now and then, because Senate Democrats have made it very clear that they will not vote to reopen the government until Republicans cave on the Obama subsidies. And they want November 1st to come so that people are impacted. Their premiums do go up, and then Democrats can point at Republicans and say, see what they did. But the reality is, all the Republicans voted to pass the continuing resolution and keep the government open. It was the Democrats that voted no, and it is the Democrats that are saying they won't vote to reopen the government until the Republicans give them what they want. This is a continuing resolution. It is not the FY26 budget. It is merely keeping the government open while they negotiate on the budget, which is the appropriate place to litigate the Obamacare subsidies. But, you know, the reality is President Obama and congressional Democrats promised us that Obamacare would lower healthcare costs. And the reality is they are climbing, climbing, and climbing, and at the same time costing taxpayers billions of dollars every year in subsidies. ACA has been an abject failure, and we are seeing that come home. And right now, I mean, I just don't know how President Trump and congressional Democrats and Republicans don't get together and figure out a way to reform our healthcare system and that injects free market principles, lowers costs, and improves care. Because right now, what we're seeing is probably some of the worst state of healthcare in America mm-hmm. in our lifetimes.
But hasn't that been the criticism that a lot of people, including President Trump in the first term, is saying, I don't like Obamacare. I don't like the way this is going. But what's the alternative? What's the plan?
Yeah, and that's the problem. You know, we have a third payer system where the doctor and the patient have less to say about the treatment than the insurance companies do. You know, it is very complex. It touches a lot of political constituencies and special interests. And so it's been really hard. You know, I am no healthcare expert, so I don't know that I have the solution, but there have been over the years a number of proposals on the right and the left that would lower costs that just haven't gotten daylight for one reason or another. And I think hopefully the crisis that we're experiencing in healthcare does compel the executive and legislative branches to get together and figure out a way, because this will be one of the dominant three issues in the 2026 elections. And just by default, Democrats tend to get the benefit of the doubt when it comes to healthcare. So if I were in the Republican leadership or in the White House, I'd be figuring out a real market-based solution where we can lower price, improve care, and make sure that the poor have coverage. Right now, this thing is hemorrhaging, and it's going to get worse before it gets better.
And we got about a minute left. Jason, I got to ask you about President Trump's demand for this $230 million from the DOJ. It's pretty unprecedented, and especially since his former lawyers are now the top officials who are going to evaluate the claim. How do you see the optics of the president potentially approving this massive taxpayer payout to himself?
Well, I think it is wildly inappropriate. I certainly feel that, you know, lawfare was used against him, but in some of these cases, he brought it upon himself. You know, one is that the top secret documents that were at Mar-a-Lago. It was requested for him to turn those over on multiple occasions, and he decided to just ignore them.
Right.
And so then the FBI ended up raiding it, and he ended up, you know, in court over this. That was a self-inflicted wound. Why should the taxpayers be on the hook for that? I think if I were him, I would be going after Alvin Bragg over the campaign finance indictment out of Manhattan. I would be going after Letitia James and you know, her indictment.
They are going after,
yeah. Not DOJ, but they are in lawfare ways. But in terms of recovering the cost of his defense, those are the people that did it, not the U.S. Department of Justice. And so at least seek redress from the culprits in this matter. But, you know, I sorry that he had to go through this, but this dude's worth billions. And I don't think the taxpayers need to shoulder any more of the cost of his presidency.
All right. Jason Rowe, thank you so much. All the time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Happy Thursday, everybody. It's Jamie Edmonds, Lloyd Jackson, Chris Renwick still on his vacation. By
yes.
the way, we've gotten proof of life. He's texted us.
Yes, he has.
I think he's drinking some Italian wine, enjoying the Italian countryside, and he's doing just fine.
Oh, he's fine.
Yeah, he's good. I wonder if he's keeping track of all of these headlines. Otherwise, he's got a lot to read when he comes back
yes.
into the States, one of which is the president putting these sanctions on Russia, and how this conversation, the rhetoric has been changing as we talked
about. It goes back and forth.
Right. We talked to Austin Gullett yesterday, our Russia expert, and he sees the change too. And no tomahawks yet. But what the president has decided to do is put sanctions on two of Russia's largest oil companies.
Today is a very big day in terms of what we're doing. Look, these are tremendous sanctions. These are very big. Those are against their two big oil companies. And we hope that they won't be on for long. We hope that the war will be settled. We just answered having to do with the various forms of missiles and everything else that we're looking at, but we don't think that's going to be necessary. We would like to see them just take the line that has been formed over quite a long period of time and go and let's, you know, go home. Last week, they had almost 8,000 soldiers killed. Many Russians were killed last week. Many Ukrainians were killed last week. We think it's ridiculous and would like to have it end.
That has changed, too. Just hold the line, basically, and go home.
Yeah.
When, you know, a week or two ago, it was like, I think Ukraine could take it all
back.
Yeah. So things have been changing. Obviously, they're trying to change the calculus when it comes to these sanctions. And according to experts, these companies targeted Wednesday are two of the world's biggest energy companies. Together, they export 3.1 million barrels of oil per day. This Rosneft one alone is responsible for 6% of global and nearly half of all Russian oil production. So they're hoping it moves the needle.
Yeah, I hope so. But, you know, you're dealing with Vladimir Putin, and I just don't think he really cares. He's going to do what he wants to do. And, you know, the sanctions are big, and they may hurt, but you're dealing with this guy, and I hope it doesn't escalate into something more, but I just don't see this guy coming to the table saying, okay, let's talk now, and I'll talk to him because you put these sanctions on my oil.
Right.
Please don't.
J.D. Vance, Kushner, Witkoff, all in Israel, and there was that headline that they're babysitting.
Uh-huh, yeah.
J.D. Vance says, no, we're not here to babysit. The ceasefire deal, still fragile, still kind of uncertain, but he had some thoughts on the reconstruction of Gaza and what's next for this deal.
We think that we can start reconstruction of the areas that are free of Hamas very quickly. We think that we could potentially get hundreds of thousands of Gazans living in that area very quickly. But again, this is all still pretty early, but that's the basic idea.
That's the idea. Hopefully, everyone's saying hopefully.
Well, yeah. We're all hopeful. A transport truck driver, Jamie, he claimed to be lost nearly, became the first vehicle to cross the new Gordie Howe International Bridge, even though it's not open yet. The driver coming from the U.S. side.
The accidental first driver.
Yes, exactly. He came from the U.S. side. He was intercepted by Canadian officials, and he was turned back, no problems, without incident. Officials say the driver was trying to find the nearby Ambassador Bridge, and he became disoriented amid the size and complexity of the construction site. The Canada Border Services Agency confirmed that no firearms were drawn and that multiple security barriers prevented the truck driver from entering Canada, so no legal penalties were issued. And the Gordie Howe Bridge had been scheduled to open late this year, but officials now say the opening has been delayed till 2026 to allow for some ongoing testing and quality reviews and construction milestones, including connecting the bridge decks and dismantling the tower cranes, have already been achieved. And so officials say the incident highlights the security measures, though, that are in place on the crossing, supported by massive cables stretching from concrete pillars to the deck. So, you know, no harm, no foul. You got disoriented, went on the wrong
bridge. It is confusing around there.
Yes.
Especially with the barrels, you don't know where to go. And so I'm glad that cooler heads prevailed. Yes. No one's in trouble here.
Nobody pulled a gun. Nobody said, oh, no, you know, and he was sent back. No legal penalties and everything's fine. But just a mistake.
Yeah, just a mistake. And also, I saw this on Local 4 yesterday, Kwame eulogizing his mom.
Which is hard to do when it's your mother to eulogize your mom at the funeral. Detroit gathered yesterday to honor the life and legacy of former U.S. Representative Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick, who died October 7th at the age of 80. She's a longtime public servant. And Cheeks Kilpatrick, she taught in the Detroit public schools before serving in the Michigan House from 1979 to 1996. She was in Congress from 1997 to 2011. And she chaired the Congressional Black Caucus and served on the Appropriations Committee, brought a lot of money back here for different projects that we see that are going to still continue well after she's gone. After the service at Greater Emmanuel Institutional Church of God in Christ, family and local leaders remembered her as a trailblazer and devoted mother and a strong matriarch. Mayor Mike Duggan called her one of a kind, and Governor Whitmer highlighted the public dollars that she brought to Detroit. And as you said, Jamie, former Mayor of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick, spoke of her fierce love, her discipline, her faith, and recalled some personal moments even during his time in prison. She visited him twice a month while he was in prison,
mm-hmm.
And said when him and his first wife, when their marriage was dissolving and she would not bring the kids to see him, that his mother would fly from Detroit to Texas, get the kids, and then they would get in the car and drive to Oklahoma to see him. Did that twice a month.
Twice a month?
Yes.
Wow.
So she's inspired a lot of people. A lot of women, you know, behind her really hold her up because she kind of paved the way for a lot of political women. You know.
But didn't his political troubles sort of derail hers?
That and that's something that that bothers him to this day. He knows that, you know, she had nothing to do with what was going on here with him, and she was doing her job, but she was guilty by association and lost the election.
Right. Okay. There's something going on right now that hasn't been done in 500 years.
Wow.
Yeah. King Charles becomes the first British royal to pray with the Pope in 500 years.
Wow.
That's a little sound from the Sistine Chapel in this meeting between these two. It's King Charles, it's Pope Leo. They're together in the Vatican Sistine Chapel, the first joint worship, including an English monarch and a Catholic pontiff since King Henry VIII broke away from Rome in 1534. There were Latin chants, there were English prayers. Charles, of course, is the governor of the Church of England. Mm-hmm. He was sitting there with the Pope. And basically, they're saying this is a healing of history. The king and queen, Camilla, had been planned before, but Pope Francis got sick and died. But,
yeah.
but the idea is to sort of bring these two religions, these two peoples, back together in the holy year of 2025. So it's a big deal.
Wow. I'm like, why did it take 500 years? Whoa.
I don't know, but here we are. Here we are. The Red Wings dropped, so now their winning streak stops at 5. They dropped one to the Sabres, 4-2. The Pistons weren't so great in Chicago, so now they're 0-1, but
that's okay.
Just one game.
It's early.
Dwayne Casey put it to us, like, it doesn't get any easier. They've got their home openers, the Celtics, coming up in a couple games.
Yeah, but they'll be up for that because it's the Celtics. So I think they'll be up for it.
Okay. You heard it here first from Lloyd. Coming up next, this idea of President Trump asking the Justice Department to pay him. What are the legal and ethical problems here? Let's ask Barb McQuaid at 819. Plus, we're going to give away $1,000, that keyword.
Welcome back to JR Morning. President Donald Trump and his legal team asking the Justice Department to pay him about $230 million to settle two federal damage claims stemming from investigations conducted during both his current administration and the previous Biden administration. Now, the move raises questions about presidential accountability, the scope of executive power, and whether taxpayer dollars could be used in such a settlement. And joining us to break down the legal and political implications is Barb McQuaid, law professor at the University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Professor, good morning.
Good morning, Lloyd. Glad to be with you.
You know, this the potential for conflict of interest here is significant. You got, you know, the top Justice Department officials reviewing the claims previously served as Trump's own defense attorneys. And so how serious is that conflict, and what should the DOJ be doing to maintain some ethical boundaries here?
You know, this, like so many things in the Trump administration, this is just something that has never been encountered before.
Right.
If you put this on a law school exam as a hypothetical scenario, the students would roll their eyes because it's so improbable that it would happen. But here we are. You know, there's an interesting statute that makes great sense. It is under the Federal Tort Claims Act. If you want to sue the federal government for injuring you in some way, the first thing you have to do before you can go to court and have a judge or jury decide your case is you have to file an administrative claim. That is an opportunity for the agency and you to avoid the expenses and time of going to court by looking at the claim. And sometimes, you know, I can remember when I was U.S. attorney, somebody got hit by a postal truck or something.
Mm-hmm.
They filed this administrative claim. You look at it and you say, yeah, they did. And a fair settlement here would be $50,000. And you say, would you take it? And the person says, yes, and let's save the time and expense and settle out of court. Makes great sense. The problem is when that plaintiff is the president of the United States, everybody who's making that decision is in some way conflicted because, as you said, the top leaders at the Justice Department actually previously served as Trump's own lawyers. I would think most people would agree they need to recuse themselves. But even if you go down the line, because President Trump is the chief executive. And as he has pointed out, he's essentially the chief law enforcement officer of the United States and the head of every federal agency. That means everybody down the line at the Justice Department works for him.
Right.
So as he himself said, it's almost like I'm deciding this case myself.
Mm-hmm. What about recusal? Like, could these people that were his former attorneys recuse themselves? I mean, there's still the look of an ethics and conflict of interest.
Yes. Now, Pam Bondi and Todd Blanche, both of whom have served as private attorneys to Donald Trump, in addition to serving at high levels in their administration, have said they will follow the advice of ethics officers at the Justice Department. One challenge there is that Pam Bondi fired the chief ethics officer at the Justice Department in July. And so, they've sort of sent a message that we like ethics advice that furthers our interest. And so can you truly get an objective viewpoint there? But I think at the very least, those two would have to recuse themselves. And then you'd have some other decision maker who, although they're still technically all in the chain of command, at least would be free from those direct conflicts of having represented President Trump before, career people who could perhaps look at this more objectively.
In both of those cases, the Russia investigation and the Mar-a-Lago, the classified documents situation there, the Justice Department, they ultimately didn't prosecute because of the sitting president policy. So does that give President Trump any legitimate legal standing for restitution, or is it more of just a political maneuver?
Yeah, really interesting question. You know, I think with regard to the Russia investigation, because no charges were ever filed, the claim that President Trump has raised is malicious prosecution. I think that one's going to be a non-starter. The Mar-a-Lago one is a tougher call because he was initially prosecuted. There were charges filed in that case, and it was ultimately dismissed because of his reelection to the presidency. But because charges were initiated, I think there's a possibility that he would have a valid claim there. But I will also say, in my opinion, it's not a claim that would prevail in any court. And that's because there is evidence that a judge found probable cause to support the search warrant of his home, and a grand jury found probable cause that charges should be filed. And so you have to show that a case was brought, was completely frivolous, vexatious, brought in bad faith. And I think it would be hard for him to show that. The problem is, it's unlikely to ever get to a court, because it's going to be a DOJ person who looks at it first under this process I just described, you know, for good reasons, but I think without ever anticipating that the plaintiff could be the president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Barb, this is one story out of many that are coming out of this DOJ. Some of it is this perceived, you know, prosecution of enemies and things like that. Are you worried about the perception of the DOJ, trust in the DOJ moving forward?
I am. When I was at the Justice Department for 20 years, I think all of us thought of our work as being done without fear or favor, without regard to politics, and also with independence. And that part was so important. I was appointed by a Democratic president, President Obama, but nobody ever got in our way when we wanted to charge the Democratic mayor of the city of Detroit, Kwame Kilpatrick. And that's the way it's supposed to be, right? Looking at facts and law and making decisions. The thing about these charges that concerned me the most was that social media post by President Trump directed to Pam Bondi saying, you know, we need to indict these people. You mentioned Jim Comey and Letitia James and Adam Schiff. You know, do it now. They're guilty as hell. We can't waste any more time, et cetera. That really, I think, clouds the at least perception of independence. Now, maybe the people who charge these cases did make their own independent decisions. But when you've got social media posts like that out there in the public domain, I think it at least creates concern that this is politically motivated and not based on facts and law. And I think in the long run, that's going to undermine every case the Justice Department brings. We hear those arguments from time to time. Mayor Kilpatrick raised that argument. I'm only being prosecuted for political reasons. But we were always able to diminish that and say, no, it's based on the facts and the law. I worry that as time goes on, if we hear this sort of rhetoric, jurors are going to be likely to believe that cases are being brought politically, mm-hmm. and will be less likely to return a conviction, even when the facts and law are on their side.
Barb McQuaid, one attorney said that it's hard to imagine how these cases that the president is talking about could amount to $230 million in damages. And so, what would the legal team for the president have to prove to justify that figure? Where did that figure come from?
Yeah, so I imagine it comes from a couple of things. One is legal fees that he had to expend to pay for his defense. He had some pretty expensive legal teams. Of course, he fundraised to support a lot of those legal fees. But also, I imagine harm to his reputation. People who read about criminal charges presume that the person engaged in criminal activity, and so that could be harmful to one's reputation. But I think if I were advocating against these payments, I would say, how much did it really harm his reputation? He got reelected president of the United States. And so I think it might be hard to prove that case. As I said, if this case were brought to court, it's hard to imagine either liability or damages in anything close to that amount. But it may never get that far if someone at the Justice Department approves this settlement.
Barbara McQuay, law professor at University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Always appreciate your insight on these matters here on JR Morning.
Thanks very much for having me.
Coming up, it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. We'll talk to a breast cancer surgeon from Henry Ford next at 8:35.
Welcome back to JR Morning. We're talking about Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and so many people are affected by this in so many different ways, whether it's you yourself or family members, or, you know, you follow like Olivia Munn, who's this actress who really put the word out there about certain tests that all of us should get. Let's ask a doctor all of these questions. Dr. Teresa Schwartz, breast cancer surgeon at the Henry Ford Cancer Institute. Thanks for joining us, doctor.
Of course. Good morning to you guys.
So, you know, breast cancer awareness happens every year. We know about mammograms. I mean, some people might get complacent about all of this. What would you say to folks?
I think it's easy to get complacent with it. It's hard to remember every year whenever you're supposed to get the imaging. And to be honest, any test that's looking for cancer can be anxiety provoking. And there are some people that would rather kind of push that off. And if you don't know, it's a little bit more comfortable. But that's what I love about October. It's almost like a gentle tap on the shoulder to remind everybody, you know, hey, am I up to date? Is my mom up to date? How about my coworkers? Just to give it a little bit more of a center of the conversation so that yearly mammograms don't simply get forgotten.
Doctor, let's talk about screenings. And for women listening right now, when should they begin regular mammograms and how often should they be getting them?
Yeah, that is a great question because there has been a lot of back and forth about this amongst different societies. And I think everyone is on the same page now that for the average risk woman, starting screening mammograms at age 40 and then doing them yearly for as long as they're healthy is what seems to make the most sense and do the best at catching cancers as early as possible.
What about, you know, some women take this test that Olivia Munn has talked about. Maybe people don't know what that test is. Could you tell everyone this familial test that's out there?
If she's talking about the just standard genetic testing, that is definitely widely available, and it's something that's just a simple blood draw that looks at your DNA to see if there are any errors or mutations that could allow more cancer cells to develop than in someone who didn't have that mutation. But there are also even tests that can be done that look for a wide range of potentially hereditary predispositions to other cancers besides breast. So there's several on the market, but it really depends on what your personal risk factors are, family history, and what makes the most sense in terms of that individual patient for screening.
You know, doctor, there's sometimes fear or even guilt around getting screened, and people worry about the results or they put it off. How do you encourage women to move past that hesitation and just prioritize their health?
Yeah, it's completely natural because no matter what test you're taking, I don't care if it's a simple math test or if it's getting a test looking for cancer, as soon as you take it, you're always worried about how you did on that test. You know, we all want an A+. Nobody wants a test to be a failure. And if you don't get the mammogram, then you'll never know, like head in the sand. You know, if there's a cancer, I just don't need to know about it. But I am definitely more of a grab the bull by the horns approach with this. And it is more empowering, in my opinion, to find something as soon as you can so that you're treatment options are greater, that your chance of survival is greater. I always am saying, hey, there's no reason to be afraid because the script is written. If there is a cancer there, not getting your mammogram isn't going to make it go away. So whatever we can do to catch things before they're palpable, before they're a big problem, that's the best chance at having someone survive this disease.
Sorry, I didn't have the name, but she promotes this breast cancer risk assessment tool to figuring out what, you know, score you would get and if you have more proclivity to get breast cancer. Do you know about that one?
I see. I do. We do these all the time. I apologize. I thought it was more of a test that gets done in the office. But this is a risk assessment tool that honestly is readily available on the internet. But there are several options for it. But it allows you to enter in all of your personal risk factors, height, weight, whether you're of Jewish heritage, your gynecological history, and then all of your family history that's relevant for breast cancer risk, as well as breast density that gets reported on your mammogram. And it allows you to calculate what your lifetime risk of breast cancer is. So we do these all the time in the office in order to see if someone is considered high risk. Because if you are of higher risk, which would be a greater than 20% lifetime chance of getting breast cancer, then you're a candidate for supplemental screening with things such as MRI, potentially, eventually, even contrast-enhanced mammography, in addition to regular mammograms. So that's something that can easily be done in any physician's office. A lot of times you can do it yourself on the internet to calculate your own risk, but it's a way to put all of your own factors into an algorithm to see what the risk looks like for you specifically.
Speaking with Dr. Teresa Schwartz, breast cancer surgeon at the Henry Ford Cancer Institute. And Dr., you know, Henry Ford's this Hello Beautiful event. Tell us about that. The name is so inspiring.
It is, and I'm actually excited. I haven't seen this movie, but I know a lot about the book that the author based the movie upon. So I'm excited for it as well. But it's more of a story about a patient who went through a breast cancer journey. And unfortunately, breast cancer doesn't say, does it look like the right time on your calendar? Is the rest of your world going well that this diagnosis fits in? You know, cancer goes in along with everything else, whether you're having trouble at work or starting a new job or balancing kids and spouses and vacations. And it's trying to navigate all of that. And a lot of times whenever you look, I mean, on anything on social media, it's either a rainbows and roses kind of approach that everything is perfect, or it's the exact opposite, you know, 180 degrees about how tough chemo was or how poorly someone did with treatment. And a lot of times we don't see the backstory. We don't see everything else that had to be navigated while going through cancer treatments. And we also don't hear the success stories very often. You hear about whenever people do poorly, but like any review, you almost feel bad if you had a cancer that was easily treated and you didn't have trouble during that treatment. So this movie, I'm so excited to see it, but it gives a little bit of insight into what it's like to have cancer amongst everything else going on in your world and how to put that all into perspective, lean on the people who are closest to you and still have an active role in the world around you while going through treatment for cancer.
Very important topic to talk about here today. I just think that, you know, you can even get some of these reports that, oh, you have dense breasts, but then what are you supposed to do if insurance doesn't cover an MRI?
Yeah, the density part, that's been relatively new over the past 10 years, but it's supposed to be another way to make sure patients know, hey, you got to pay closer attention to your exam or the mammogram may not simply be enough. With 3D mammography, it does as good of a job as we can in terms of screening imaging of kind of putting that breast into 1 millimeter cut so you can scroll through it. But 40% of women who go in to get mammograms end up being in that higher density risk category. So it's not uncommon to have dense breasts on mammogram. And I think it's more of just a, hey, you got to pay attention if something changes on your exam. Okay. Doing a breast MRI is helpful for some patients, but for a regular screening tool and someone who's average risk, it's not that great of a tool. Mammogram actually does a better job. So every single mammogram is different and every patient attached to that mammogram is different. So if you get a notification that your breast density is higher on imaging, it's worth a conversation with your primary care doctor, your gynecologist, even the breast radiology team where you get your imaging. to say, is there something else I should be doing personally? Because a lot of these places, and Ford is one of them, you get a generalized risk assessment whenever you come in to get your mammogram. So it's kind of an extra piece of the puzzle, not really a standalone piece that I would tell anyone to worry too much about.
Great advice here this morning from Dr. Teresa Schwartz, surgeon at Henry Ford Cancer Institute. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. You guys have a great day.
You as well.
We appreciate it. And you know what I did not do is give out the keyword at 8:19. So let's do it at 8:43.
Okay.
How about?
Very good.
All right. Here's your chance to win $1,000. You text this hour's national keyword, which is SHOP, to 95819. That's S-H-O-P to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. You can't text and drive, but you can play five times each weekday for five chances to win. It's 5K a day on 760 WJR. Official rules and more information coming up on WJR.com. And good luck. We have a big game coming up on Saturday, Michigan-Michigan State. Let's get into it at 8:49. All right, look, we're going to talk about Michigan-Michigan State, but a huge headline crossed my desk here. Breaking news, Heat guard Terry Rozier and Blazers coach Chauncey Billups arrested in a gambling probe. What is going on here? There's going to be a 10 a.m. press conference by FBI Director Kash Patel in the Eastern District of New York announcing numerous arrests in illegal sports betting and poker game schemes.
Oh, man.
Members of organized crime groups are among the couple of dozen expected to face criminal charges in two separate illegal gambling-related cases. And, you know, we know Chauncey.
Yes.
Not Chauncey.
Not Chauncey Billups.
He became the head coach of the Trailblazers in 2022 after the 17-year Hall of Fame career with seven NBA franchises, one of which, of course, is our Detroit Pistons.
Of course.
So I don't know what to make of all of this. Do we have our guest? Guys, do we have our guest? We have our guest. Okay. Tony Garcia, sports reporter at the Detroit Free Press, joins us. And I was going to ask you about the green and white and maize and blue, but can I ask you about this, Tony?
Yeah, Jamie, good morning. I think I had the exact same reaction you did. That was probably the reaction across Metro Detroit. It's not Chauncey, right?
Right,
right.
A lot of people looked up. I mean, I was a young kid when Chauncey Billups was doing amazing things for the Pistons in 2004. I was in fifth grade, and so
your impressionable years.
Yes, exactly. So we looked up to him a lot at that time, and obviously, as you get into this business, you realize and. I mean, everybody's just human and people make mistakes. And so we don't know exactly what's happened yet. So not jumping to any conclusions quite yet. Like Malik Beasley was in some hot water and seems that he might be getting out of it. That remains to be seen. And so you just don't want this to be the case, right? So I don't know anything more than that, but just that's pretty sad if something goes down with Chauncey.
I'm seeing here that he was arrested at an unknown location, but his involvement is reportedly not tied to games he coached.
Okay. Well, again, we're going to wait for that information at 10 a.m., of course, and maybe we'll have you on again here to talk about that. But today we're supposed to be talking about Michigan-Michigan State Thursday before the big game on Saturday. And Tony, do you think that there's as much hype as there used to be when, like, both teams were ranked?
Well, no. I mean, I think the short answer is no, right? There have been a handful of these games in recent memory, and some of them are getting in more distant memory. 2015, of course, is the one that really comes to mind, the trouble with the snap game. Both teams coming in undefeated, top 10. And then even 2021, both teams were undefeated when they met in East Lansing. That was the last time Michigan State won. Michigan State actually won both those games. But the last 3 years, I mean, these two teams have really just been on different playing fields. In 22 and 23, Michigan was going to the college football playoff. In 23, they won the national championship. Michigan State has not been to a bowl game during that time. And their coach now, Jonathan Smith, seems to, possibly be on the way out after just 2 years. There's a lot of angst in East Lansing. Michigan fans not thrilled with the way things have gone through a year and a half under Sharon Moore, but there was a win over Ohio State last year, which earned him a lot of goodwill. And after things went sideways a few weeks ago against USC, Michigan righted the ship against Washington. And there is still a path to the college football playoff. They got to win out. But just in terms of juice around this game, there's not as much as usual, obviously still a good amount, but not like when they're meeting with a ton on the line.
You know, and Tony, you know, these rivalry games, they often come down to emotion and momentum as much as talent. You think the Spartans can harness the home field energy and keep things competitive early?
There's a chance. There's a chance. I mean, sometimes, in a different way, I equate it to that Michigan-Ohio State game where Michigan seemingly had nothing to play for but pride, and Ohio State was trying to finish running the table there, and Michigan just came in and stunned them. And that was away, right? That wasn't even at home with their own crowd getting into it. So sometimes when you've lost four in a row in the league, it feels like there's absolutely nothing to play for. The team that you dislike the most coming to town can bring the best out of you. And it's sort of an if not now, then when
right.
mentality, right? Like this is the spot to leave it all out there. I expect possibly trick plays, fourth down attempts. You have nothing to lose. If you go down swinging. So that's what I would expect from Michigan State.
Let's do this. What does each team have to do if they want to have a chance to win this?
Michigan State, you said?
Both. Do both.
Oh, both. Sorry. I think Michigan State, if they're going to win, Aiden Childs is going to have the best game of his career. He is going to have to protect the football. He's going to have to find Nick Marsh early and often. Usually you set up the run with the pass, but Michigan is top 15 against the run. Michigan State is about 102 in the nation coming in rushing. So they might have to do it the opposite way. They might have to use the pass to set up the run, like show that they are going to take shots, lighten the box, and then start hitting Michigan in the middle. Michigan just needs to not get outside itself, right? Like this is a team that is more talented on both sides of the ball. They have more experience, not just winning this game, but playing in big games. And so, in seven games this year, they've won the turnover battle six times. They're 5-1 in those games with the only loss at Oklahoma. And that was Bryce Underwood's road debut at an SEC stadium. So that was a pretty tough spot as it was. So they just need to, continue to run the ball, whether that's Justice Haynes, if he's back. He missed last week at Washington. Could be Jordan Marshall. The team who has won the rushing battle has won 48 out of the last 55 of these games. Mm. So Michigan's focus is going to be on controlling the ball, keeping it on the ground, chewing up clock, and then letting Michigan State press and try to beat them. And that's when they'll capitalize on what they expect will be some mistakes.
Well, it's a night game. All these night games here in college football. It's Saturday night, Michigan and Michigan State. Thank you so much, Tony Garcia of the Free Press.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And back to that breaking news that Trailblazers coach Chauncey Billups arrested in a federal gambling probe. And there was going to be a 10 a.m. press conference with Kash Patel.
Well, we'll learn more.
We'll learn more there, of course. I know Kevin will be on top of it. That's 10
okay,
a.m.
He's ready.
You can bet on it.
Oh. Well, actually, they shouldn't be betting on it. Right. All right, so you hear Kevin Dietz. All Talk is next. Lloyd and I will be back tomorrow morning. We're going to talk about this reno of the White House.
Yes.
And Tom Izzo. Join us from 6 to 9 a.m.